So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at the latest research on perennial crops for biofuels. And one of our guests who comes by really often, John Greenler, with us today, and Greg Sanford back after an extended, hadn't been on for a while, let's put it that way. But they're back. John, of course, is the Director of Education and Outreach for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. John, great to have you again.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Appreciate it. And Greg Sanford, a scientist at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and sort of an agronomy background, or at least a plant background as by way of profession, is the first author on a recently published study on perennial crops. And we'll talk about those crops and how they fared compared to maybe annual crops and get your input. Maybe you have a question or a comment for our experts as we talk about perennial crops for biofuels. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you, certainly. And Greg, thank you, by the way, for coming by. I appreciate you being with us. And you were, was it 4 years ago now?
I think it's about 4 years ago. Yeah, that's right.
We talked about your research and explain what you were doing or what you have been doing.
Correct. 4 years ago, we were talking about some long-term bioenergy trials that we had established here in Wisconsin and in southwest Michigan. And at the time, we were kind of up and running with those trials, but hadn't generated a lot of data, and we're kind of in the process now of digging through the data that we have generated and trying to publish stories from it.
So, and what, when you're collecting data, and maybe John, you can talk a little bit about it, how does that process work?
It's a really interesting story, and Greg can go into the details, but I think in many ways what we've been trying to do in GOBRC is to be very scientific, have replicated experiments, but also really be bringing into that the pragmatic world of farming and using technology in the field that really would allow us to directly be able to extrapolate and say, yeah, this is what should be happening on a farm. This is how much we should be getting. These are the challenges, the opportunities. Yeah.
So trying to really replicate in some ways of what would go on a quote-unquote normal farm.
Right. There's a little bit of a tightrope we're walking because we're trying to generate data for ecologists and soil microbiologists, but we're trying to run the trials we have using large-scale equipment, large fields, things that would give us all the things we might see on a farm field. So it's kind of a balancing act for us. Yep.
It is one of the exciting things about this paper that just got published, on which Greg is their first author, is they have data which is very much of the ilk that an ecologist would be looking at in terms of kind of a more natural type of a system, but then also has yield data that would be very understandable or be able to directly relate to what would go on in a farm. And so really trying to create that intersection of kind of ecology and agronomy so we can really get this multidimensional view of what's going on out in the field.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the reasons I was thinking about environment for us to do research on perennial crops as opposed to annual crops.
Correct. Well, the center, the GLBRC, has a strong sustainability research focus. And so when we look at what bioenergy fuels of the future might look like, we're very interested in systems that are perennial or might mimic perennial. So if we have annual systems that have cover crops in them, those types of things. And so what we've laid out is this broad swath of potential perennial cropping systems alongside annuals and annuals with these diverse cover crop assemblages. So
it's pretty cool, and we're going to talk about that research and some of the results of the research. John Greenler and Greg Sanford are guests today. You can join in again, too, with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Not sure I mentioned it, but you could also email us at talk@wpr.org, or if you'd like, you can post on our Facebook page, and our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. So, and I guess the main crop that we've had for all these years has been corn, which is not a, well, I guess it's not a perennial here anyway. Is it a perennial anywhere?
It's an annual. It's an annual, regardless of where it is. But that's right. We have a lot of experience growing corn, and corn is certainly the first feedstock for ethanol, grain ethanol, and it's turning into the first feedstock for cellulosic ethanol. So the plants that are up and running in the country are sourcing their feedstocks from the stover or the plant residues that are left after harvesting grain.
Yeah.
It is an interesting side story, but there is research going on to say, can we perennialize corn? So Wes Jackson is a researcher down at the Land Institute in Kansas. It would be a tremendous opportunity. It's not happening anytime soon, but it's a really interesting research endeavor. They actually are making more progress on wheat, something that maybe will come along in the not-too-distant future. So,
oh, is that right? Well, you know, corn's a kind of a nitrogen utilizer, and some of our perennial crops, on the other hand, may be a little less tough on the nutrients in the soil.
Right. Many of the perennial grasses are have very high nitrogen use efficiencies. Corn has a pretty high nitrogen use efficiency, but as an annual crop, our systems are inherently leaky. So all of the nitrogen that we're putting down isn't making it to that crop.
Yeah.
The perennials tend to do a better job of fully kind of exploring the soils and the nutrients they have available to them just because of their root morphology and the time in which they're growing. So,
and let's talk about the perennials that you were working with and maybe why you're working with those particular perennials.
Well, this gets back to that kind of balance beam we're walking between ecologists and agronomists. So agronomists like to turn the knobs and figure out how to make things run perfectly. You know, what's the exact amount of nitrogen or phosphorus or potassium we need to put down for a crop? But we can't possibly do that and ask broader questions about landscape sustainability with these systems. So what we did was we laid out crops that kind of follow some clear, a clear matrix of. So one of the clear distinguishing characteristics is perenniality. We have annual crops, we have perennial crops, but then diversity is big for us too. So we have monocultures or single crops being grown in a field, and polycultures. And within that matrix, then we've tried to pick things that represent kind of the industry standards to date. So we have switchgrass, which is a monoculture perennial warm season grass. It's native to this area. We have Miscanthus giganteus, which is a sterile hybrid of two South Asian grasses, which has gained a lot of popularity as a bioenergy crop because of how phenomenally productive it can be.
Especially in Europe, it's an interesting story. Just that, you know,
is
internationally,
that right?
Globally, yeah, much more common.
Yeah. It'll outcompete, or it'll grow better than switchgrass?
Well, with the switchgrass we have available in the north right now, which switchgrass has different ecotypes. We have upland and lowland, and currently in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes states, we're limited to upland northern varieties of switchgrass. And compared to those varieties, yes, Miscanthus is much more productive.
Oh, okay.
One of the ways we're trying to develop, Mike Kassler here at the UW in particular is working to develop switchgrass that's more productive is by taking those lowland southern ecotypes and developing them so that they're winter hardy here. And by doing that, we have plants that don't go to flower and don't set seed. They continue to grow vegetatively and end up being much more productive.
Yeah. Really, really interesting. So it's primarily Miscanthus and switchgrass then?
Well, those are our monocultures.
Yep.
We then have diverse systems. So we've got at one extreme of our diverse systems, we have a native prairie planting, which would have been the ecosystem that our great grandparents would have found, or great great grandparents as they settled the state. The southern part of the state was prairie. And then we have more simplified mixtures, but where we're looking at these perennial grasses like switchgrass or Indian grass, big bluestem, mixed together, but without the forbs, without the sunflowers and the legumes. So it's a continuum from strictly monoculture native grasses to diverse polycultures that would have been the habitat around here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they must look pretty when they're on.
They look gorgeous.
Oh, man.
They look gorgeous. And we have one of the biggest populations of songbirds at the research station. So I mean, we've got a lot
no,
of
it's
stuff
really
going
a treat
on.
To go out there in the fall, yeah, when the when the prairie's really peeking out, early fall. It's spectacular. Yeah. And that's a valid service that our agricultural acreage can provide. That aesthetic is not trivial. It has value.
And aesthetically and for the life of other things.
Mm-hmm.
Birds and insects.
That's a whole other area of study is, are looking at, what are the benefits that we can provide at the landscape level, especially to our farmers by having, a matrix of biodiversity on the farm. Just, having some acreage in these biodiverse crops provides beneficial insects of a wide variety that will then, they'll find a home in this perennial polyculture planting, but they'll move all over the farm and beyond and really be broadly beneficial.
Mm-hmm. We have callers. We have a question from an email from Judy in Fitchburg. By the way, you can join in too. The number to call 1-800-642-1234. Any questions about that you want to know about the perennial crops or the annuals for that matter? What experiences do you have perhaps with perennial crops and biofuels? Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our page. Judy in Fitchburg wonders, are any agricultural economists or UW Business School economists involved with your research? Do you know if anyone's looking at the long-term economic viability of these crops in comparison with what will soon be the lack of viability of coal and tar sands? She says she guesses crops will never be stranded assets. So we got somebody with a little economics background there. You want to comment?
I'll dig a little bit into that, and then maybe John can follow
up. We can bounce back and forth, you bet.
We do, within the sustainability group, we have kind of the issues of production, which are important to us, and then the issues of environment, which are important to us. But certainly the crops won't make sense if there's not incentive to grow them. And there are a number of economists that have worked with the trials over the years. Theo Skevas at Michigan State University actually is in the process of publishing data on the systems. Of course, the data is promising and also highlights the challenges of getting perennial systems up and running, but there's currently not a lot of financial incentive mm-hmm. to grow the crops. So from the standpoint of developing a market for them, we would see the economics for the systems changing probably in a much more positive way than they look now.
One of the things that's interesting, so we have, a number of economists also looking kind of through the lens of the farmer, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because these crops are so different. When we think about, corn or soybeans, which is so prominent in our landscape here today, it's, there's a market and the market, fluctuates on a, annual, very regular basis, and farmers are making decisions about, what to plant where, when. And it's really different when you're talking about a perennial crop. Some of these crops, you've got a 2 or 3 year establishment period, and then really to get the full,
there's no money
full
coming.
Benefit, right? You may need to have that crop in the ground for, 10 years or maybe even, not that long to start making money. But, clearly the longer the perennial crop's in the ground, the better your return's going to be because there's that initial investment. And so, looking at, what does the farmer need, not just in terms of the machinery of handling these crops, but also in terms of, structure for pricing and and whatnot is really important. So, yes, we have some economists, Brad Barnum here at UW-Madison, Scott Swinton at Michigan State University, are really trying to, you know, look at all of these dimensions and what would it really take for something like switchgrass to be attractive to the farmer. So.
Talking about crops for biofuels today with John Greenler and Greg Sanford from the University of Wisconsin. Great to have them with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Breon Chesso, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today as we take a look at perennial crops for biofuels with our guest, Greg Sanford, who is the first author on a recently published study on perennial crops like switchgrass on biofuels production. John Greenler directs education and outreach for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Questions? So we've got lines are all full here. Numbers 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Mark in Brookfield first here. Mark, hi. Thanks for calling.
Great. Thanks for having me on today.
Sure thing.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask your guests if they've done any research with industrial hemp. In the work that I've done with it, or research I've done, I found that it's huge amount of cellulose in it and has a potential for cellulosic ethanol. And that's actually a byproduct off of the plant after you've already used the bast fibers and the oils and stuff like that. So I'm wondering what kind of research you guys have done so far into industrial hemp as a source of ethanol from the cellulose.
Okay, well, let's turn to Greg first. Greg?
Sure. Thanks, Mark. We have not worked with industrial hemp as part of the bioenergy research at the UW, in part and from the biggest standpoint, because we're focusing on perennial crops. Industrial hemp clearly is highly productive, and if somebody were producing fiber from it, you could have that secondary stream that could be used for potential energy generation. But from the standpoint of energetics going into the system, you still have seed purchases and planting, fertility, which makes the crop much more similar to something like soybeans or corn than it would to something like switchgrass or miscanthus or prairie. So we've really focused from an environmental and production standpoint on perennial systems.
Yeah.
But, Mark, I think you make a good point that if the hemp was being grown for some other purpose and there was a residue component to that that was very high in cellulose, then there would be a significant opportunity to take advantage of that material that might be a waste otherwise. So, I think as the industry proceeds, there might be significant amounts of utilizable material there. So, yeah, good call. Good question.
Chris in Two Harbors, Minnesota, up next. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
My question is, fossil fuels, how do they play into ratio-wise when you're making ethanol using the biomass? Or is there a good enough ratio where it's really cost-effective? And I just want to make, I was just curious.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, that's a good question, too.
It's a mission-critical question. I really appreciate the caller coming on because it's not obvious, but you're exactly right. Any of these biofuels are going to require some level of fossil fuel input. And so what we really need to look at here is what's known as a life cycle assessment, how much energy goes in versus the energy, that we get out doing and accounting. And, when we look at corn grain ethanol today, our predominant, biofuel, there are very significant energy inputs kind of all along the cradle to grave or plow to pump process, so to speak, just from the seed production to, as an annual, we're having to plow or at least do no-till work with a big tractor every year. The nutrient requirements are very high for corn, and nitrogen especially is very energy intensive to produce. And so when you add that all up, it's interesting. If we were talking 20 years ago, to be honest with you, as far as I understand it, we were probably looking at a losing proposition. We were probably putting more energy in than we were getting out. The good news is the industry has gotten a lot more efficient in the past 20 years. And I think we are, by and large, we're seeing a positive beneficial yield, but it's still not great. You know, we're maybe, you know, maybe, you know, 2/3 of the energy, functionally speaking, that we get out is coming in through fossil fuels. The great news with these perennials is that they're much more efficient in multiple domains. One is that you plant the crop once and you're going for, you know, probably 8, 10, good chance, you know, more years. And so you're really cutting down in terms of just the mechanics of what's required. And then furthermore, these perennial crops are much more efficient, as we talked a little bit about earlier, in terms of nutrient use, nitrogen. They essentially recycle that nitrogen internally every year. You know, at the end of the season, they take the nitrogen out of the above-ground biomass, take it down to the roots, store it over winter, and then next spring, they bring it back up again for, you know, for another year's growth above ground. And so much more efficient. And, you know, now we're looking at the numbers are still preliminary because we're just getting into this at a commercial scale. But, you know, I think it's more on the line, you know, ballparking of maybe like 20% of the energy that you get out is functionally kind of coming in as fossil fuel. So a big, big reduction.
There we go. And Rod in Weyerhaeuser up next with a question. Rod, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, see, thanks for taking my call. But, you know, you're talking perennial. I noticed stuff, canary grass, my dad, you know, he said that his dad, my grandpa, put that stuff in the late 20s or 30s, the adult years. And when we'd make hay, I know, if we got it before it was like a foot and a half tall, well, it was digestible for the cows. It was, you know, it was a filler and little nutrition. But that stuff, if you let it grow. It was 6 foot tall. I know he'd disappear with the tractor and sickle, and you know, he'd disappear, you know, because I'd go with the hay crimper. But the bobolinks love it, and the blackbirds love it. And this stuff was put in, Grandpa put it in the late 20s or 30s, and it just keeps growing and growing, and it's spreading. And he said it's an invasive species. And, I mean, Dad used to say if you cut that stuff full size, you'd probably only get 10 acres to fill a 40 by 15 silo. It's, I mean, you're talking volume.
All right, so canary grass, and Rod, thanks for calling, by the way. What about canary grass?
Rod, very interesting observations and question. I assume we're speaking of reed canary grass, which certainly can be a major invasive issue. There are populations of reed canary grass which are native to the Great Lakes regions, so it's a little bit of a tricky subject, but from a biomass standpoint, certainly there is potential turning that biomass into a cellulosic feedstall for ethanol. It's an incredibly productive grass. It's a rhizomatous perennial grass, so it does a good job of holding its own. There's been some also interesting work within the Jackson Grassland Ecology Lab at the university looking at managing the invasibility or the invasiveness of reed canary grass, specifically by harvesting it for biomass, that if we can selectively harvest or harvest at the right intervals, we can potentially force those populations back or significantly reduce their vigor. So certainly there's some potential. There might even be potential harvesting biomass of this type for management of the invasibility.
Right. But I think we do want to make clear that, you know, as you were saying, you know, it is a very invasive species. And I think in general, you know, we really don't want to see plantings going in of reed canary because when it gets away, and I think it's pretty much a given that it will get away, it really does cause a lot of problems in our agroecological kind of landscapes.
Yeah. Right. If you were going to plant a bioenergy crop, there's probably a lot better options.
Yeah. Please, don't plant reed canary. Yep.
Colin in Dubuque, Iowa, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello, hello.
And what can we do for you?
Well, I just had a question. Years ago, I had heard about using algae in a way to produce energy. And I just really, I don't remember anything about the process, but I was just wondering if it's in use or still being researched and just,
sure.
Anything about it at all.
Sure thing. And John Greenler, there's been some research on that.
Oh, and there's a lot of research and development that's going on, continuing to move forward with algae. You know, we like to think of it as kind of being maybe a third generation type of fuel. This, you know, the current systems that we're looking at kind of converting this fibrous or cellulosic plant material is second generation. Algae, the research and development is further down the pike. It has a lot of promise. It has a number of challenges as well. There's a lot of infrastructure that's involved when you begin to think about the pumps and the plumbing, et cetera, and the corresponding energy input. So once again, we're back to this life cycle assessment. We need to make sure that we're really looking at something that is giving us a, you know, a strong positive yield. The other one, which is not as obvious, but which is really significant, is looking at water as a resource. And growing algae, clearly, they're, you know, it's aquatic plants, and water is increasingly, freshwater especially, is increasingly limited, requires a lot of energy, actually, to utilize that water. You know, I think a whole area of research which is interesting, which is going on today, is trying to develop algal systems that would be able to use brackish water. So if we could be using ocean water or something similar, and that would really be a game changer. And it does look like, you know, down the pike that should be coming. But, you know, that will really make sure that, once again, we're not tapping into a very limited critical resource, that being our fresh water.
Yeah. I think there's quite a bit of research going on in Asian countries about crops and brackish water.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some potential there for sure. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call, Colin. Jeff in Fox Lake has something. Let's go there. Jeff, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Yeah, I got two questions if you got time. The first one pertains to the distance. Now, if we're talking about these biomass crops where we're taking the whole plant, is that in the planning process as far as how far this is getting transported? Because when obviously, I'm guessing we're going to be baling this in large squares or large rounds, and you've got to move it to the plant to be processed. You can't be trucking too far. You're going to lose your efficiency by burning up the diesel fuel.
Yeah. No, that's I know what's been considered, and John Greenler.
Yeah, once again, you know, very great call, Jeff. You know, you're right on track because, you know, as this biomass comes out of the field, it's very, you know, high volume, low density. Yeah, and you start trucking that stuff very far, and the energy to drive the truck is really going to put a big dent, you know, in your return. We actually have some very interesting research going on with chemical engineers looking at kind of a multi-tiered processing structure where essentially there would be a local processing facilities, which, functionally speaking, would go through the first stage of preparing that material for conversion. And there's a bit of fortuitousness to this in that it's very easy to then densify that material into a pellet. Looks very much like, you know, if you know what a current, like in the wood pellets look like, that might go on a stove, looking very similar to that. So it then is easier to move around. It's also easier to store. It's not going to mold or rot as easily as well. And then that would furthermore get trucked, you know, a further distance to a larger refinery where there would actually be the conversion to the liquid fuel.
There's also the added benefit within that structure that the pretreatment and densification of the material enables us to use a lot of the infrastructure we have in place to handle grain. And in the processing of the plant biomass, we make it easier to convert to fuel, but it also becomes much more palatable and digestible for livestock, so there could potentially be dual-use streams for the feedstock after treatment.
A lot of interest in developing countries, for example, in that kind of adding that dimension of versatility, actually being able to feed this pelletized material to, for example, cows in India.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there we go.
All right. I had a second question pertaining to seed source for this stuff. Like miscanthus, is that grown for seed? Does it have to be grown in the tropical region, and how far away would that have to be done?
Jeff, thanks. Miscanthus actually does not. The miscanthus that we're growing for bioenergy is it's a sterile hybrid. So it's called Miscanthus giganteus. And it does not produce seed, or at least we think it, for the most part, is not producing viable seed. So when we're planting miscanthus or attempting to establish it, we have to establish it from rhizomes, little cuttings of below-ground root structure. There are a number of greenhouses and nurseries now that are selling giant miscanthus because it is a beautiful grass. People are planting it as an ornamental.
Yeah.
And so there are a number of nurseries, if you just were to search giant miscanthus rhizomes, I'm sure you'd be able to find a source of it. There has been some work attempting to develop a giant miscanthus that you could plant via seed. That work has kind of stopped here in the United States, but I know elsewhere in the world those technologies are being pursued, where you could plant things out in large quantities in a greenhouse and then maybe transplant directly live transplants to the field the way you would in the vegetable industry or something like
that.
There
we go. Thanks a lot for that, for those questions, Jeff. And let's go back to your research, Greg, which sort of touched and nibbled around the edges of it, but talk about your findings.
Well, you know, we set out to ask a number of questions about these perennial crops, and what we found, I mean, we found a lot of things and been publishing on productivity and greenhouse gases, et cetera, but in the recent manuscript, we see that the vast majority of the perennial crops we're growing are equivalent in terms of biomass production with corn stover, again, which is the current go-to feedstock for cellulosic ethanol production. In many cases, the bioenergy crops are far more productive than corn stover alone. So switchgrass, in general, is much more productive than we would get from a corn stover feedstock. And then in terms of some of our crops, like giant miscanthus and hybrid poplar, we see that those crops over the course of a 6 or 8 year period can produce as much biomass as an annual corn crop. So these are perennials, as John mentioned. We're putting a lot less energy into them. We're putting a lot less fertility into them, and they're phenomenally productive. And one thing John and I were talking about on the way over here that's important to remember is that we have been growing and developing and improving corn now for well over 100 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Many of the crops we're talking about, switchgrass, miscanthus, that were really at the beginning stage. We haven't really unleashed their genetic potential per se, and so we don't see anything but improvements in terms of those results.
Right, yeah.
The other thing I'll just chime in here briefly that we really haven't talked about is the benefit in terms of reduced greenhouse gas emissions associated with these types of biofuels. You know, very much tracks the efficiency in terms of reduction in terms of fossil fuel inputs. But, you know, as we look towards the future and the, you know, the very real potential for a carbon tax or carbon cap and trade, you know, that will internalize these external costs that we have in terms of these environmental issues. And, you know, and global warming, I think, is a climate change is a really good example. And that will really increase the value, the return on these types of biofuels. So I think increasingly it sounds like, you know, not too far in the future we're going to be seeing that. And this will really provide a big boost in terms of the economics of these types of crops and corresponding fuels.
Very cool. Denny and Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Denny, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. My son, in 2010, did his master's thesis, which was a theoretical study on using Willow River State Park by Hudson, Wisconsin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And his paper was on a multi-use prairie management to provide a sustainable yield of carbon-negative biofuel feedstock. Well, also providing habitat for rare, threatened, endangered species and so on. But it allowed public use of the park as it is now, and but also provided these other things. And it was done on by doing the mowing on a rotational basis so that it would be sustainable. And it has big and little blue stem, switchgrass, Indian grass, plus a whole number of forbs that are there also. And so anyway, so it was
pretty cool research, actually. Mm-hmm. it was
neat. It's not been done. He doesn't live in Hudson anymore. It was a neat theoretical study that never got done.
Yeah. But you know what? John, maybe you can talk about this. But others are looking at this. As we've talked about a little earlier in the show.
I mean, this is, is something that we do see significant potential in, and are looking at all these dimensions to be able to, take a harvest of the above ground biomass to turn into fuels, and at the same time, be able to, so to speak, reap the benefits of all of these other services that a native ecosystem can provide. Mm-hmm. So right on track.
Yeah, it's pretty cool research, actually.
Yeah, his paper is through the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Currently, he's a sustainability director at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. So,
oh, very cool.
And my daughter just graduated from that school. So
that small world.
I'll bet she knows him then.
Good chance. Wonderful. Small world.
Thanks, Denny. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, that's pretty cool. David in Madison has an interesting question, too, I think. Hi, David.
Hi, Larry, and hey, great program. I am new to this topic, so I'm learning a lot, and it's fascinating. And I just kind of riffing off one of the comments that your guest made about ethanol being 75% efficient in terms of fossil fuel use. I'm wondering how efficient or how inefficient is fossil fuel production in terms of using fossil fuels?
Yeah, that's a question we don't get very often.
Oh, yeah, that's a really insightful one. And, the answer is, it's a very mature industry, and they've done a really good job over the years of making it very efficient. So for every unit of, for example, gasoline that you, fill your car up with, at the station, you're probably looking at maybe like a tenth of a unit of energy to actually get that to your car. So, between the pumping and the refining and the transportation, it's very, very efficient. It's very impressive, but it's still a fossil fuel, and it's still even if it is that efficient, it's still significant in terms of a whole host clearly of environmental and sustainability concerns.
Very, very cool. Thanks a lot, David, for calling. Yeah, sure. Appreciate it. And maybe we have time for Richard in Madison. Richard, do you have a quick question?
Yeah, maybe it's too soon in your research to determine this. I've read a book called Geofuels, Energy in the Earth by Alan Carroll.
Yes.
And I think the energy rate on investment for corn is about 1.5 to 1. Would you ever be able to exceed that?
Beat that?
Yeah, I think the bottom line is we're going to be able to do a lot better than that. Alan's actually a good colleague of ours. We have this conversation with some regularity. Yeah, and the good news is kind of moving beyond corn grain to ethanol, we're going to be able to see, much greater efficiencies. Corn, it just takes a lot of energy to get that corn grain. And so if we can be moving into this fibrous plant materials, these cellulosic materials, we're going to be able to drop that way down.
Way down. And Richard, thank you again for calling in. And Greg, you're going to continue with your research, I'm sure.
Yes, it's ongoing. We're expanding. We're going around the state. Yep, absolutely.
So, well, let's see. You were here 4 years ago. Let's try and make it less than 4 years, fewer years than four.
Absolutely. Sounds
for your
good.
Next trip back. Thank That's you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
And John, we'll look forward to your next visit, too. John Greenler, Director of Education and Outreach at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Greg Sanford, scientist at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. His own university department is the Department of Agronomy as well. So, and he's the first author on that recently published study on perennial crops. And by the way, that's available, I'm sure. People want a copy to see a copy of that.
Sure. I think we can make it available.
There's actually a great summary that's available on the GLBRC website. If you go to glbrc.org, you'll be able to actually read a really good feature article.
Synopsis of it, yep.
Yep.
Okay, there we go. And there's we have a link to that on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show as well. So that's a good thing. And actually, it's kind of fun to go to that Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center site anyway. There's lots of stuff on there for sure.
Yeah, we're blessed with a great communications team.
Yeah, good group of people there. Well, good group of weather people at the University of Wisconsin as well. Two of them are our weather guys, and they're up next to talk with us about probably some snow out west, out east, and What about the onset of cold temperatures? Coming up next on the Ideas Network.